Well, James Purdy, it's certainly a pleasure having you here. I've certainly known your reputation for many, many years. I think a nice way to start would be for me to ask you a few things about yourself, and then we'll talk about your books and about the new book, of course, which I've just finished reading.
Oh, good.
But I'd like to find out a little bit about you and your childhood.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about you. Where were you born?
I was born in the country. The nearest town was, I think, Fremont.
So that was in Ohio?
Yes.
Not far from the Indiana border.
Very close, in St. Joseph's River.
What year was that?
1923.
What was it like growing up in that rural area?
It was sort of wonderful, I thought, compared to my life since, I think. And my parents were divorced when I was about 12, I think. So then I had to live with, sometimes with my mother, sometimes with my grandmother, and so on and so forth.
All in this area of...
No, I moved from wherever they were living at the time, you know. So that was... I realize now, living with all one's relatives, because I had an enormous band of relatives, that really helps you be a writer, is listening to all these people talk and partaking of their lives.
Were the relatives that you had growing up in Ohio as exotic as some of the people you write about?
I think so. Yeah. I think everyone's really exotic when you get to know them.
How long did you live in Ohio?
Well, until I was about 16 or 17.
And then where did you go?
Then I went to Chicago.
So your childhood was divided to a certain degree between the rural life
and the city, urban. Yes.
Uh-huh. Where were you educated?
Well, that was sort of haphazard since I moved so much. But I did sort of attend the University of Chicago for a while, but I really never liked school, though I loved reading. And then I was drafted into the Army, and I learned a great deal there. In fact, maybe I learned too much. And then after that, I sort of traveled all over the world. I went to Spain. I got a job teaching in Cuba one year, teaching English. And at that time, I've changed since. I like to wander. I couldn't get enough of that. Now I like to stay in one place. But at that time, I couldn't get enough of wandering. Especially foreign countries.
Never occurred to you to settle down someplace and work in a store or an office?
No, I never liked daily work. I found that very oppressive. And in fact, I think I'd rather... I have washed dishes, too, in restaurants when I was hard up. But I would rather do that, I believe, than work in an office. I have worked in offices, too. But I found those very almost crippling psychologically. Just the, the regular hours. And
tell me about it.
And I think being a writer, people say writers are lazy. That's true in a way, but you see, when you're a writer, you're always thinking about your writing. And that takes a lot of, I think it was Gertrude Stein said it, it takes a lot of loafing around to be a writer, because your mind is on that.
In your childhood, growing up in Fremont, Ohio, did it ever occur to you that someday you would indeed be a writer?
I sort of always wanted to write, yes. In fact, I wrote, I was always writing these little things which my mother found, and she's quite puzzled by them, because they seemed rather outlandish. They were really just descriptions of people, what we knew. But they were written, perhaps like my books, with such a unconventional view, perhaps, vision. You're not supposed to write that way about people. You know, you're to write respectfully and with cliches. You're not supposed to write about them, I guess, the way they are.
That's very interesting. Let's jump ahead a little bit. Your first book was 63 Dream Palace.
True.
And I understand, I'd like to know about the origins of that book, because I understand that it was privately printed by a group of friends.
Yes.
How did this
By
come
one
about?
Friend. Mm-hmm. Well, I had been writing stories since really high school. And when I was in my 20s, I wrote an enormous amount of stories. I hate to even say this, but most of them are lost. Because, you know, when you move from one place to another, you become, perhaps careless isn't the word, but you lose things. And now when I write I'm beginning a new book, and I immediately went out and got it Xeroxed. I was so afraid I'd lose it. Because once you've lost what you've begun, you will, at least I would never be able to rewrite it.
No, it would not be the same.
No, it would be different. So I met in Chicago, I met a woman who is a proofreader on the Chicago Tribune, and she married a very wealthy man from Iowa who was also a kind of writer. He did, in fact, write a book on Henry James and one on Conrad. Well, she was so struck with these stories, which I showed her, and we couldn't get anyone to publish them. She showed them to him, and he was sort of thunderstruck by them. So he published those stories privately under the title Don't Call Me By My Right Name. That was 1956. Another friend of mine was also struck with a short novel I wrote, 63 Dream Palace. Unlike Mr. Andreas, he was very poor, but he wanted to print that. And I said, well, you know, why don't you let him print it, because he has money. He said, no, I'm going to print it. So those two little books, I sent those. Well, after they were published, Mr. Andreas said, what on earth are we going to do with them? Here we are, we have all these books. We had nearly 1,000. And I said, why don't we send them to people that are, you know, sensitive poets, mostly. So, though I did not know her, I sent the first book to Edith Sitwell in Italy, at the Castello dei Monte Gufoni. I didn't know her. She didn't know me, of course. And I didn't think she'd ever even get the book sent to a castello, let alone if she got it, she'd never read it. But I was more thunderstruck than Mr. Andreas when I got this letter from her. And she was very moved by these. So moved that she took them to her publisher, Victor Golanz, who's a famous publisher. But you see, the second book hadn't appeared yet. I was a little afraid of sending her that book because it's about something really very terrible in the true sense of the word. And it also uses language which at that time wasn't often in print. But I sent it to her. She was even more impressed with that, I think, in the first book.
Well, that was 63
Dream. Yes, that was 63 Dream. She'd already read the stories. And Don't Call Me By My Right Name. Well, then she insisted that these must be published. And Victor Golanz agreed to publish them. But at the last moment, at that time it seems impossible, but in England there was criminal charges brought against both a writer and a publisher who used certain words that today you hear everywhere. Among wealthy people, even cocktail parties. But without telling her, he removed some of those words. And that made her quite upset because she felt the words had to be there. It's about, as you may know, it's about a young man, 19, who comes from West Virginia to Chicago with his brother, who's slightly, just slightly retarded, not, you know, not really what we call. And what they go through is so terrible. And he more or less accidentally murders his brother. So it's a story which still disturbs people who haven't read me. And now it's in, after all those years and all those trials and tribulations, it's in Penguin paperback, which I guess some people think that you're a classic now.
So your first trade publications were actually in England.
Yes, I was first published in England, because the American publishers were not at all impressed with me.
So you still, I know that you have a large following in England, a very large following, but I wasn't aware of this historical reasons for it.
Yes. I think it both helped and hindered me, because they also took the book in Italian before it was published here. And German, the Germans, the Italians, the Danes, the Dutch, let's see who else. They all took the book because it created a sort of scandal in England too, because they had never read anything, they claimed, quite this, they used different words, shocking, and which is a little ridiculous when you think it was in England we had the Jacobean drama, Elizabethan drama, Chaucer, so forth.
The English are always
stuffy. I think
this was in the mid 50s. What were you doing to make a living during this period? Certainly not writing.
No, I did about everything to earn a living. But you see, I didn't like steady jobs. I don't have jobs now either. I did do some teaching, which I liked the students, but I hated the, you know, the superstructure. And I found most of the professors, I don't know, they weren't in touch with my world, to say the least.
Well, this brings us up to 1959 and your first novel published in the United States, Malcolm, and I noticed on the back, just marvelous.
True.
Blurbs.
True.
What? Tell me about the origins of Malcolm.
Malcolm.
Mm-hmm.
I was living with, or not living with so much as I, this gentleman gave me a room in his farmhouse. He was living near Quakertown, Pennsylvania. And he's the one that published 63 Dream Pals. He was, of all things, a physical chemist in a research laboratory. And he said, you know, you shouldn't really work if you can write books that are make Edith Sitwell fall down the castle steps and Angus Wilson. If you can make those people practically kneel to you, you're totally unknown. I think you should just either starve to death. But while you're starving to death, you should write. You should never go to work again. So, you know, that was...
So you took his advice.
I took his advice.
Did you starve?
Well, I've had bad times. But I had a place to live, you see. Because I had this top floor to myself. So I wrote Malcolm, and I would show him parts of it as it was finished. And he said, you know, this is the funniest book I ever read. He said, in fact, I was reading some of it the other night and I had to lie down on the floor to catch my breath. And he said, of course, no one will ever publish it.
And such bizarre characters. The midget who refuses to recognize his smallness and his white, the white mold on the face. And did you have difficulty finding a publisher?
Yes. In fact, the first publisher to turn it down was Viking. I won't mention the man who is indignant over it. He was also, I think, outraged that I was recognized in England. But Viking turned it down with great moral fervor.
Shame, they just republished it.
Yes, they republished it. They've had to eat crow. Of course, everyone who was there then is gone. It's a totally different publisher. But there was one gentleman there who I really liked. He was a Romanian, and he was then rather advanced in age, but not mentally. That was Pascal Covici, who had been a great publisher in his own day.
Who was that?
Pascal Covici.
Oh, the editor of Steinbeck.
Yes. Mm-hmm. He also had his own publishing company before he had failed.
Covici Fried.
Covici Fried. And he thought I was it. And he was very upset when Malcolm Cowley persuaded Viking not to publish me. They really did not think I was a respectable writer. And I think that's correct. I'm not in the sense they think of as respectable. I was not, and I am not. By that, you know, I don't mean that one is riffraff or trash, but these books they've been sort of put in their coffin before they were successful.
these early rebuffs that you had, how did that make you feel? Did it make you want to continue to write in any event?
Yes, more. And I still get lacerating reviews, usually from people no one has ever heard of. But it's really, if you don't mind being knocked down and hit with bricks, it's a form of compliment, because you know these books have reached them somewhere, because the reviews are written with such rage. And actually, they're not saying anything about the book. What they're talking about is how they're outraged. This has touched a raw nerve. So one can sort of take it as a compliment.
But there's a whole other half of the literary establishment that adores your work and don't
hear
your work.
True. I'm the most extolled and damned writer, perhaps.
As a matter of fact, I saw probably on a blurb, but I think it said referred to you as a literary treasure.
Oh yes,
I don't remember who said that, but it was, and it's certainly accurate. I have this little critical study of you.
Oh yes, that's excellent,
Stephen Adams.
Yeah, that is very good.
And he says in his critical study of you that some of your readers are quick to either claim or reject you as a gay writer.
Mm-hmm.
How do you answer that, sir?
I don't think anyone could be either a gay or a straight writer anymore. You couldn't, that to me, I couldn't belong I think an artist, a writer, writes from the psyche, or some people call it unconscious. You write from your soul. You write from all of you. You write totality, you know. And that's what I write from. So I never wrote a straight or a gay novel, and never will, because I think it's sort of like maybe they've been called a Christian vision, but when Jesus approached any human being, he didn't approach them from any category or pigeonhole, you know. He accepted the person totally. It was a total acceptance of the person. Every human being was sacred, was to be taken seriously, was to be accepted in toto. And I think that's what the writer, you know, has to do. You have to accept your characters completely.
I have a number of other questions that I want to ask you, but I think before we go too much further, I think we ought to talk about On the Glorious Course, your latest novel, which I read with great interest. And I think it would be interesting for me to ask you, for you to describe the book and how you see it and how it developed in your mind.
Well, actually, like all my, I think all books are autobiographies in the sense that it comes out of your knowledge. That I, by autobiography, I don't mean that the characters in it are me, necessarily. But this came out of my childhood, in part. And as I say, I had so many relatives. I think I had countless cousins, uncles. And, you know, you don't have to search for models. So this book, in a way, is very much based on my own memory of small towns.
Was this small town as moralistic as the small town? I can't remember the name of the town.
Fontiel.
Yes, although this takes place, I believe, in Illinois.
No, Ohio.
Is it Ohio?
Yes,
Ohio. Oh, this is in Ohio?
Well, actually, I don't really think it takes place anywhere.
I just got the idea. It was maybe because there were references to Chicago a lot.
That's true. It's near Chicago.
Yeah. But at any rate, almost everybody in On Glory's Course attacks someone else for their moral deprivation.
True.
And was this the way it was in 1930 and the 1940s when you were growing up, where the town was so moralistic that everybody was shocked?
I think on the surface, yes, it was. And under the surface, it was just the opposite. But I think people are that way in New York, because there are a lot of taboos here, you know. It seems that anything goes, and then suddenly someone does some little thing that seems to me not worthy of notice, and they're condemned by this so-called emancipated culture.
Can you draw, at the end of On Glory's Course, is it possible to draw a conclusion about the people in this small town?
Yes, perhaps. I think we all fall down in this sense that we judge other human beings. And that is always a mistake, you know. I just don't think we have a right to judge other human beings in such a totality. And gossip certainly thrives in New York, too. But when we really understand someone, I don't see you can't judge them anymore.
Tell me a little bit about some of your working habits. You say you don't like regular work. you're living in Brooklyn Heights.
Yes.
Why did you decide to come to New York? And when was it?
I came here permanently, I think 1960. Well, I didn't have the money to keep traveling back. I was living in Pennsylvania.
Quakertown.
Yeah, near, in the country. Near, between... It was sort of near Quakertown and Allentown, out in the country. And I didn't have the money to keep coming here to see these publishers. And I don't know whether I made a mistake or not, but I moved here with no money. And
that's not the wisest thing to do.
No, and by then I couldn't leave because I didn't have the money to leave. And I didn't have any possessions except some mementos. And I couldn't take the place I was living in, New York City. It was a horrible place. So a friend of mine told me about a room in Brooklyn Heights, and I've been there ever since.
The same place?
Yes.
You're talking about a room?
It's a, well, some people call it an apartment. Mm-hmm. It's more like a room. It's a very nice room. It has a view. You see trees. It's fairly quiet. The house is quiet. Mm-hmm. And that's where I wrote nearly everything.
How do you organize yourself?
Well, I just start writing in the morning.
You get up and...
And start writing. Sometimes nothing much comes, but...
Do you always tend to have a project?
Oh, yes. I'm into a new novel now. I've also written a lot of plays, which have been produced off Broadway, and in Australia they're doing them right here. But I really like to write those plays.
Tell me a little bit about the poetry.
Oh, yes.
This is another side of James.
Well, Curry. I've always been writing poetry, and it's dreadful to say, but I really... Well, of course, I thought maybe my stories were no good because people wrote such cruel things about them. I remember one... I won't name the magazine. It's still flourishing. I wrote a story about black people because I have known a lot of black... In fact, where I went to school, they were always black, so I didn't know about integration or segregation. But at any rate, I wrote the story about two black women, mothers. And I was quite young then in my 20s. I sent it to one of these slick magazines. Of course, blacks weren't in then. And they wrote back and said, "We suggest you go to school and learn English." And that story now, Eventide, is in about 30 anthologies. It's been translated into 15 languages.
What story was that?
Eventide. It's in 63 Dream Palace.
That's right.
It's about black. In fact, people thought I was black when 63 Dream Palace. They thought that... And Langston Hughes, who liked the book, I found out after he died that he thought I was a black writer. And that was because I deal with blacks in that book. Color of Darkness itself, I guess, fooled them.
Well, even I Am Elijah Thrush.
Yes, I Am Elijah Thrush.
The hero.
Yeah, the hero
Albert,
is black.
Albert. And it is Albert.
Yes, Albert Piggs.
Yes, right.
Also, some of the later short stories. So I thought that was a great compliment. They thought I was a white man writing about black people.
Isn't it wonderful that you're still making people mad?
Yes, I love that.
You have been doing some teaching as well.
I taught at New York University. I taught at Long Island University. I taught, where else? Some other places, I guess. Out in California. They organized some little classes when I was living there. Yeah.
Creative writing.
Uh-huh. But I don't really like teaching much.
The Philadelphia Inquirer had a wonderful line that I picked up in one of the reviews, and it said, "Sometimes reading you is like dreaming."
Oh, yes, that's nice.
That's wonderful. Uh-huh. And that's the feeling that I had as I read On Glory's Course. I was puzzled at first before I began to become more and more amused by all of the goings on in that small town. At first I was puzzled. I expected something. Well, after the father, after reading about the father who shot his head off in a hunting accident, I thought, well, this is going to be grim. And it is grim in many respects.
In places, yes.
And yet, there were times I just found myself chuckling, and other times I felt myself just moving on, almost like, well,
dreaming. Swimming. I'm always reading these old Greek books. I found a thing in here I loved. It said, "Sleep is the goddess of the muses." Sleep is the god of the muses, and you know, I think explains what I do, in a sense, because in real dreams we do find out the truth, while in our waking lives we're so. You know, living is so hard. Earning a living is so hard. Surviving is so hard. We often lose track of what life really is. And in dreams, or when the muses speak to us, it sort of explains it all.
Who do you like to read?
Oh, today?
Mm-hmm.
I don't read much fiction anymore. I read a recent novel. They sent me The Galleys, and it's called Square Dance by Alan Hynes. It's coming out in July. And I liked that quite well. It's about a young girl growing up in Texas a generation ago. Mm. And it had a truthful quality I liked.
William Burroughs was telling me a week or so ago that he doesn't really like to read anything other than, well, trash. He likes to read science fiction books, novels about doctors.
Oh, I see.
And things that he can read rapidly and easily without having to think too hard.
Uh-huh.
He also says he likes the trash because he can mine little nuggets, little ideas and things that he can use in his own novels.
I see.
Well, I think I would like to wrap things up by asking you, and although my broadcast is so short, I don't know that I have the form for it, but I'd like to try. I'd like to ask you if you could read one of your poems, a short poem.
All right.
Because you've just brought these in, so
yes.
I would like to ask you to select...
You can see perhaps why composers set these to music, because I never wanted them published, and then they started doing them, and they were done at Alice Tully Hall, at Lincoln Center, and so my publisher said, you'd better have these printed, or you're going to end
up... copyrighted.
Lose your copyright. So I sort of liked this one, which was set to music. Over green leaves that stretch to the sea, but a sea that is grass and has leaves and trees, flowers of a thousand hues. This is the sea that is billowing but not blue. When the wind bends down to kiss its head, the grass is all waves without being wet, flowing and rising and falling and towering. The green sea, so kind to wanderers. The wind bends low and kisses again, and small birds rise from their nests content.
Like dreaming.
Yes, it is, dreaming again.
James Purdy, you certainly are a literary treasure, and I thank you very, very much for coming in and
talking
to me.
Thank you for having me.